Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's December 6, 2019 program, Driving Towards a Low Carbon Future with Electric Vehicles. This is the 13th program of our 2019-2020 programming year. My name is Eric Richardson, and I serve as City Club of Eugene President. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of City Club of Eugene at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors, Kaiser Permanente, University of Oregon, Peace Health, and Lane Community College. All these partners work with us to create a thriving, democratically supported society and community. The City Club of Eugene also would like to thank the City of Eugene for its support with the recent generous contribution that allows 10 city employees to attend City Club meetings on a weekly basis as well. Thank you, City Club of Eugene. Now on to the program. I'd like to invite to the microphone Skip Colburn, who will introduce today's speakers. Skip.
Good afternoon. I've been told by our three panelists that they have worked very hard to make certain their presentations won't go beyond 30 minutes to enable as many questions to be answered during the Q&A session. So my introduction, I'm not going to bother with, because it'll take too long. We already know what the topic is, right? And we're fortunate today to have three expert panelists who are going to bring us up to speed on what's going on with electrical vehicles. First is Phil Barnard, who everybody knows. His long career in public life and also his legal practice and practice as a clinical psychologist, but he is now focused on electrical vehicles as the founder and president of the Emerald Valley Electrical Vehicle Association. Did I get that right?
Close.
Okay, well, close enough. And he's going to talk about smaller electric vehicles, you know, passenger cars, maybe lighter trucks. Our second speaker will be Kelly Hale. It took me a little while to get her name right. She's the sustainability manager for LTD, and among other things, she is monitoring the operation of the first electric buses that are in operation. She's also planning an evaluation that will help LTD in terms of its long-term plans of providing a low carbon bus system. And finally, Michael Graham, who is the Director of Policy and Communications for the Columbia Willamette Clean City Coalition, right? Okay. He's going to talk about larger vehicles. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the podium over to Phil.
Thank you very much. In the last year, we've received major scientific reports of the impending tipping points in the climate emergency beyond which there may be no return. The latest, from just last month, reports that the catastrophe is coming faster than we thought even a year ago. Current greenhouse gas emissions need to be cut at least 7.5% every year from now on until the net emissions for the world are below zero. The longer we wait, the higher that annual percentage must be. There's a lot of policy-level discussion, the Green New Deal, the Clean Energy Jobs Bill, and the like, but there is another arena that matters as well, the actions of millions of individuals, families, and businesses to reduce their own greenhouse gas emissions through changes in their own behavior. Today, we talk about a specific subset of those actions, changing the way we get around, specifically by electrifying transportation. switching from gasoline and diesel-powered cars and trucks to walking, taking the bus, riding a bicycle, or driving electric vehicles, these things together could cut our direct carbon emissions in half. Joe Levin, executive director of Plug-in America, said on Tuesday, quote, switching to an electric vehicle is the single most powerful action any of us can do to combat climate change, close quote. In 2006, Elon Musk published his secret Tesla Motors master plan on the internet, by the way. In it, he said, quote, almost any new technology initially has high unit cost before it can be optimized. And this is no less true of electric cars. The strategy of Tesla is to enter at the high end of the market where customers are prepared to pay a premium and then drive down market as fast as possible to higher unit volume and lower prices with each successive model, close quote. Tesla has done exactly that. In 2012, I traded in my hybrid Toyota Camry and bought one of the first Tesla Model S's. It was the only electric car available then that could get me from Eugene to the state capital in Salem and back on one charge. From January to June of 2013, I drove from my home in Eugene to the capital in Salem and back, a 135-mile round trip every session day. I charged the car in my garage on a standard 240-volt, 50-amp circuit, similar to what you use to operate your electric oven or your clothes dryer. Every night, charging took about 20 seconds of my time, 10 to plug in the car and 10 to unplug in the morning. My fuel cost for the round trip, about $4. It was a third of what I had been paying for gasoline for the Camry. Why the difference? ICE, that is internal combustion engine cars, used about 20% of the energy in its fossil fuel to move the car. The rest was emitted as heat. Electric vehicles, on the other hand, are 85 to 95% efficient and can move about the same distance on a quarter of the energy. The regenerative braking available on EVs also increases range and reduces the need to replace brake pads. My 100% electric car was completely reliable while I put on about 19,000 miles during that 6 months. In reality, there's very little that can go wrong with an EV. The drivetrain, including the drive battery, is usually warranted for 100,000 miles or 8 years. Any out-of-the-ordinary problem is likely to arise early in its use. EVs have thousands fewer moving parts than cars run on internal combustion engines. The electric motor, or two, has basically one moving part with some bearings. An ICE car, on the other hand, has hundreds just in the engine itself. EVs require no oil change, no engine overhauls. You do need to refill the window washer fluid. In 2012, there was a great fear that the drive battery of an EV might not last very long and would be very expensive to replace. Experience has shown that not to be true. Only a few EVs have actually been driven 400,000 miles by now, but most of them are still on the original battery with an average range of about 90% of what they had when they were new. The average car is driven about 13,500 miles a year. Accumulating 300,000 miles would take over 20 years of normal driving. Battery technology has improved a great deal since 2012. Energy density has increased and cost has decreased since then. These and better manufacturing methods are why the new models cost half as much and have a longer range than my old Model S. The battery chemistry is now much better. In 2012, EVs batteries used a lot of cobalt, an expensive metal with a sordid history. The newer batteries use much less, and there's hope that it will be eliminated altogether. The best-selling electric vehicle of the moment, the Tesla Model 3, cost half what I paid for my Model S. It has the same or more range. By the time you add in fuel and maintenance savings, the life cycle cost of an electric vehicle, especially for those who drive a lot, is less than many lower-priced ICE cars. In a couple of years, the purchase price will be lower also. Also, check out the federal tax credit on purchase of a new EV, the Oregon purchase rebate on new and depending upon your income, used EVs, and your local utility support for chargers or EV price discounts, or both. These change frequently. More EVs are coming on all the time. Ford just announced and then sold out its electric Mustang and announced its electric F-150 pickup. Tesla has two new models coming, the small SUV, the Model Y, and the Cybertruck. Volkswagen seems to have seen the light after Dieselgate and will have 50 models available by 2026. If you have a favorite brand of cars or pickups, it's probably going to have an EV in the mix soon. Skilled workers who use power tools will soon be able to get an electric utility vehicle that will power those tools from the drive battery. EVs constructed properly can also be the safest cars on the road. Motors are small, mounted on the axle, making room for big crumple zones in case of an accident. Batteries in all the newer EVs are mounted between the wheels, providing very low center of gravity, which makes them almost impossible to roll over. Tesla models have routinely received the highest safety ratings. Other EVs do very well, too. EV acceleration and handling are exciting. They start from a stop instantly. They have no gears that need shifting. A couple of times on the freeway in an emergency situation, I thought that the best way out was to speed up quickly. I did, and there was no accident. Such a maneuver would have been impossible in any ICE car I had ever driven. EVs are quiet, vibration-free, and very comfortable. Most EV owners will never willingly return to ICE cars. You need to experience one for yourself in order to really know why. In 2012, the only place I knew I could fuel was my EV was in my garage. 95% of the time, that's where I charge it still. Now, there are a few thousand public chargers in Oregon and more coming all the time. Tesla continues to build out its supercharger and destination charger system. Oregon is maintaining its Oregon Highway fast chargers. Volkswagen is rapidly building out its Electrify America fast charging system. Private vendors are adding more all the time. Most of the EVs will update their navigation software over the air, as Tesla has done since 2012. That will include the location of chargers, their availability and amenities nearby. If you tell your car where you're going, it will tell you where to fuel and how long it will take, usually about the time you need to use the facilities and get another cup of coffee. The climate emergency is upon us. Drastic action is needed. Our cities have been planned for automobile for 100 years. Most of us will continue to use automobiles to get around out of necessity or habit. How do you get over your fear of the new and the unknown and make the transition to EVs? I propose a stepwise approach. First, whatever else you do, never buy a new ICE car. The resale value of a new ICE car you purchase now will be rock bottom or non-existent in a few years. At some point, the policymakers will wake up and significantly raise the price of gasoline, restrict where your ICE car can drive, or add other costs. Don't be caught with a nearly new ICE vehicle when that happens. Be prepared to drive the old jalopy another year or two. Second, write down the daily mileage and expenses of your current vehicles. Most people drive only 30 miles a day. You will then have a very good idea of what sort of EV you will actually need. There are many short-range used EVs that have all the advantages of low fuel and maintenance cost and high reliability that can be had for very low prices. Even if you're among the 25% who buy new cars, understanding what you really need is the first step to obtaining the right EV at the price you can afford. If you drive a lot of miles, your fuel savings with an EV might make the monthly payments. After a few years of new EV sales, there will be used EVs at good prices for the rest of us. Third, learn from the current EV drivers. Many are excited about their EVs and will be happy to share what they know. That is part of why I helped organize the Emerald Valley Electric Vehicle Association. Our members and volunteers are happy to help you learn and think about through your transition to electric driving. That is what EVEVA is for. Go to our website, www.evEVA.org, or email us at contact@evEVA.org. We'll answer your questions and maybe let you drive our own EVs. Kelly?
Hello, my name is Kelly Hale, and I'm the Sustainability Program Manager at Lane Transit District. I'm so excited to be here today. Thank you so much for inviting LTD to participate. Representative Barnhart and Michael Graham are experts in their field, and I'm so excited and honored to be on this panel with them. I have three areas that I'd like to cover over the next 10 minutes. First, I'll begin by telling you about LTD's experience testing electric vehicles over the past year. Next, I'd like to briefly share with you the results of a greenhouse gas inventory study I just finished at LTD to measure both the impacts and benefits of LTD's operations on climate change. Finally, I'd like to touch on LTD's future plans and how the community can support our work. For context, Lane Transit District is a special purpose district that provides public transportation services in Lane County. We own a fleet of about 100 buses and run more than 30 routes serving both the Eugene-Springfield metro area as well as routes into other Lane County communities such as Junction City, Coburg, Oak Ridge, Cottage Grove, Cresswell, and Mackenzie Bridge. We provide more than 10.2 million rides annually, and currently our fleet is made up of about 60% diesel hybrid vehicles and 40% straight diesel buses. Over the past year, LTD has been engaged in two very exciting electric vehicle testing projects. First, starting in February of 2019, we have been testing 40-foot battery electric buses in our fixed route revenue service. Has anyone here ridden on one of our electric buses? Great, several hands. Secondly, beginning in August of this year, and in partnership with the City of Eugene, Lane County, and Lane Council of Governments, we've launched the MGO electric shuttle in downtown Eugene. The purpose of this one-year pilot program is to help encourage folks to take the bus into downtown by providing a free, yes, I said free, convenient, low-carbon way to move around within the downtown core once you get there. You simply download the app onto your phone and use it to request a ride to or from more than 70 pickup or drop-off locations within downtown Eugene. LTD owns 4 of the 5 MGO electric vehicles that we use in this service. These Polaris GEM vehicles seat 6 people, have about a 70-mile range, and cost approximately $40,000 each. They were purchased with statewide transportation improvement funds from the state of Oregon. One MGO vehicle is set up for riders who use mobility devices, and the 5th vehicle is owned by Ride Zero, the company that operates the service. Has anyone had a chance to test out our MGO service as well? Great. So when LTD began researching the viability of using electric vehicles in revenue service, we knew that battery electric technology was an excellent fit for our specific area for several reasons. First of all, we have a good supply of low-cost, low-carbon electricity in this area. We also have a mild climate in both summer and winter. This matters because if you have to excessively cool or heat a vehicle to maintain a comfortable cabin temperature, that can potentially drain the battery, thus reducing your range. Additionally, we have a fairly compact service territory, especially compared to some other transit agencies, and this can also help with range concerns. LTD's mission is to provide people with the independence to achieve their goals, creating a more vibrant, sustainable, and equitable community, and we knew that clean, quiet, comfortable rides on electric vehicles can provide a benefit for our community. What we didn't know was if the available range would meet LTD's needs and what the actual logistics would look like to implement electric buses and adjust our operations to run a brand new technology and what the life cycle costs might be. So, to get some real world experience with those things, we began an extensive testing program over the past year. As I mentioned, beginning in February 2019, we began testing our first 40-foot, 324 kilowatt-hour battery electric bus in revenue service, and we added a second bus in May of this year. I'm so pleased to be here today to tell you that overall, our testing program has been a success in that we have determined with confidence that electric buses can meet LTD's range requirements. We had asked for buses that would provide a minimum of 130-mile range, and we are often seeing results that can get us between 150 and 180 miles from our test buses. Newer buses today have even longer ranges, so this should meet the needs of at least a good portion of our routes. The buses take approximately 3 to 4 hours to charge at our Glenwood bus yard, and we are working with our partner, the Springfield Utility Board, to manage charging costs in a way that will be beneficial for both of our organizations. The buses have also had very few mechanical issues, and to date have been available to be put into revenue service approximately 97% of the time. Our riders appreciate being on a clean, quiet, comfortable ride, and our drivers love driving them. Based on the successful results of this testing program, LTD has made a commitment to have at least 11 electric buses on the road within the next 2 to 3 years. Now that you know about our electric vehicle testing programs, I'd like to put those programs in context by sharing with you the results of LTD's first greenhouse gas inventory that measures the impact of LTD's operations on climate change. As Representative Barnhart mentioned at the outset of his talk, LTD understands that climate change is real. It is an emergency, and it will not affect everyone equally. The most vulnerable parts of our community will be impacted more significantly, and so we have a moral imperative to take action now. The title of this talk is Driving Towards a Low-Carbon Future with Electric Vehicles, and I just want to emphasize that it's that low-carbon future that's the most important part of that title. Electric vehicles are a tool in our toolbox that will help us achieve that desired outcome and future. In LTD's greenhouse gas inventory, we measured both the climate change impacts from our operations, as well as the climate change benefits of providing public transit to our community. The purpose of this report was to learn what actions LTD could take to effectively reduce the harmful pollution that causes climate change within LTD's sphere of influence. We learned two important lessons that I'd like to share with you today. First, when it comes to our emissions impacts, there really is an elephant in the room. Our emissions from our owned fleet vehicles represent more than 94% of the emissions that LTD has direct control over. The good news is that there is lots of opportunity to reduce those emissions, and that is why LTD's work to date on investing in electric vehicles is so important. This is also why LTD is beginning a new feasibility study to look at all the potential fuels and technologies that are available on the market today to complement our investment in battery electric buses and determine what our long-term strategy to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions will look like. The second important lesson from our greenhouse gas study relates to the emissions benefits of transit. We measured the impact of how, by offering public transportation, we reduce vehicle miles traveled and the number of private vehicles on the road. We knew that public transit is an emissions reduction solution, but given the scale of our emissions from our buses, how would those benefits compare to our impacts? We learned that even with our existing diesel fleet, the carbon benefit of transit was more than 2 times the carbon impact of our fleet. Let me say that again. The carbon benefit of transit was more than 2 times the carbon impact of our fleet. So on net, providing public transit is good for fighting climate change, and LTD's very first priority in addressing climate change should be finding ways to increase ridership and expand service. We need to get more people on the bus, and we need your help to do that. I'm out of time, but there are just so many projects that LTD is engaged in to increase ridership, so I'll just list a few, and you can ask me more questions later. There is our service project redesign that is currently undergoing called Transit Tomorrow. There's our joint project with the City of Eugene looking at potential infrastructure investments to make it easier to bike, walk, or take transit called Moving Ahead. We just launched our Touch Pass program to make it easier to ride the bus. We launched in September our free student transit pass program for students K through 12 to be able to ride the bus for free. And we also have expanded our low-income fare programs. We have 2 mobility on demand pilot programs, the one in downtown Eugene that I mentioned earlier and another one in Cottage Grove. And we always have our group pass program as well as so much more. Please come talk to me about ways that you or your business can get involved in our work, because if we're going to address the climate crisis, we need everyone involved. Thank you so much for your time and your interest today.
Good afternoon. Thank you all for having for having the Columbia Willamette Clean Cities Coalition present on our experience with electric vehicles and also alternative fuels as a whole. My name is Michael Graham. I'm the Director of Policy and Communications here at the Columbia Willamette Clean Cities Coalition. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, as well as a U.S. Department of Energy program. We're 25 years old, and we function as a public-private partnership between on-the-ground fleet stakeholders. Those are primarily fleet managers and operators, and the U.S. Department of Energy. So we work day in and day out to help our fleet managers make the most informed decisions, provide them with resources and support that they need, as well as deploy innovative and new technologies and fuel options, primarily in alternative fuels. So, electric vehicles. I wanted to ask a question. Who knows when the first electric car was created? A show of hands. For the folks on the radio, I've got three hands. How about the sir? You are pretty close. It would be 1832. The answer was late 1800s. So definitely the correct time period. So the first electric vehicle was created in Des Moines, Iowa, here in the U.S. And between 1900 and 1912, as a matter of fact, electric vehicles kind of had a heyday here in the U.S. That was due to a couple of reasons. Primarily, gasoline-powered vehicles back then, as well as, believe this, steam-powered vehicles. Steam-powered vehicles took about 45 minutes to heat up. Gasoline-powered vehicles needed a large hand crank to get going. Gasoline also wasn't as inexpensive when the gasoline-powered car first came into invention. So electric vehicles had a big leg up over our internal combustion engine counterparts. That's because they were easy to use and they were cheap to operate. So we had a couple of limitations, though, back then, as the Model T came around and the electric starter was introduced because battery electric vehicles could not keep up. The battery technology just was not progressing fast enough past lead-acid batteries. If only they had looked at the total cost of ownership and had access to lithium-ion batteries back then. The cost for an EV was $1,700, and the cost for a Model T was a mere $650. So today, many of the same drivers are powering electric vehicles, right? The playing field's becoming a lot more level every day as the cost of batteries has been steadily decreasing. The Chevy Bolt in 2010, for a kilowatt hour of battery capacity, it costs GM $350 today, or at least in 2016, that cost was dropped to about $145. So you're getting to that cost parity with ICE vehicles. But where I'm here to provide some perspective is the fleet perspective. And fleet owners typically look past the sticker price of vehicles and factor in what's known as the total cost of ownership. That's the cost to fuel and maintain your vehicle throughout its entire life within the service of your fleet. And electric vehicles, I have to say, are number one in that category. And for two primary reasons. It's fuel and it's maintenance. So in the fuel category, you're using electricity, right? Electricity is the only fuel that is both domestically produced and consumed within the United States, as well as strictly regulated by the public utility commissions throughout the country in their respective jurisdictions. So that creates two things. It's fairly low cost and has been for quite a few decades. It also means that it's fairly stable. And this is a very interesting area where fleet managers and operators have not been able to account out and budget into the future their fuel costs, and now they can with electric fuel. And that's really important when you're looking at medium and heavy duty vehicles, which are using quite a bit of fuel. The second reason is the maintenance costs. As Phil pointed out, the maintenance costs for electric vehicles are very low because they're much simpler pieces of technology. You have a couple of motors, you have some batteries, and the heavier duty buses like LTD's buses, you may have some cooling pumps for the batteries. But then you compare that to an internal combustion engine, and let's take a diesel bus, for example, where you have very complex emissions technologies on the back end that require expensive fluids to clean up the exhaust. They break down because you move too slowly in certain vehicles. So you, with electric vehicles, you have none of that emission control technology on the medium and heavy duty platforms, meaning that you have higher uptime, and lower total cost of ownership because of the fuel savings as well as the maintenance savings. So where are we starting to see some of these electric medium and heavy duty vehicles deployed? The sweet spot is what we call return to base. So we're not talking right now about long haul trucking. This is mainly, think your last mile delivery, like your UPS trucks, your FedEx, your Amazon trucks and vans. Those are going to be your first adopters, as well as city vehicle fleets that are coming back to a home base at night to refuel, recharge. You know, maybe you have a shift change with the drivers, as well as transit buses, school buses, and even refuse trucks along certain routes. We've seen a lot of adoption in California, and that's primarily because they have quite a bit of funding and also air quality issues that have driven that access to funding. So what we're seeing is that electric vehicles in the medium and heavy duty classes are quite a bit more expensive. So let's compare a diesel-powered refuse truck to an electric refuse truck. We submitted a grant for an electric refuse truck not too long ago, and we're quoted at $615,000, which is two times the $300,000 it costs for a diesel refuse truck. So bridging that funding gap is paramount if we're going to see more deployment. Luckily, fleet managers are taking into account that total cost of ownership, right? So they're able to justify their decisions to purchase electric vehicles by saying, hey, it's going to cost a little more on the upfront, but I'm going to save money over the lifetime of the vehicle because of the lower fuel cost, the more stable fuel cost, and lower maintenance cost. So just to be clear, the age of electric vehicles is definitely here. We're seeing a lot of light duty in public fleets. We're starting to see some more of the medium duty, and especially in California, and even, I would say less green areas of the country. So, you know, this argument for electric vehicles has been spread outside of the West Coast and even into places like Alabama and Georgia, where we're seeing actually record deployments of electric transit buses because the economic narrative for electric vehicles is becoming so strong. So at the end of the day, by factoring in that total cost of ownership into your decision making, it's a lot easier to justify the procurement of a more expensive vehicle, and we're starting to see a lot more of that across the country as well as at home here in Oregon. So thanks for your time. I really appreciate it, and I'm more than happy to take questions and comments.
All right, thank you for those presentations. We'll be taking a small break now where we can formulate our questions and hope you all have some vigorous conversations and bring some strong questions to bear. So we'll be back in 5 minutes. Thank you.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
All right, well, welcome back to the December 6, 2019 program, Driving Toward a Low Carbon Future with Electric Vehicles. Before we proceed, I'd like to say a few words to recognize some of our sponsors. This week, we sent out our winter newsletter. In it, you will find information about our future programs, our financial condition, and a profile of one of our active members. We ask that you review the annual appeals section. In it, you will find the description of an exciting prospect for the City Club that you can help facilitate. Now I'd like to thank and recognize our gold sponsors. That's Homes for Good, Arriving by Bike, Evans, Elder, Brown, and Schubert. And our Sapphire sponsors, AARP of Oregon, who celebrates creating livable communities for all ages. Learn more at aarp.org. Now on to the rest of our program. We'd like our first questioner to come to the mic. Thank you.
John Reynolds, a City Club member since 1990. This question is probably for Phil. How universal is the charging technology for residential vehicles, because I've heard that Tesla has their own system that nobody else can use, and I'd like some truth about all this.
Thank you. That's a great question. The technology for charging is at the level which that suggests that there is not yet a standard for charging. However, if you're talking about charging in your own garage, every vehicle comes with a charging cable. Some of them only come with a cable that can charge on a standard outlet, like some of the ones you see around the room. Others come with a cable that will allow you to charge on a 240-volt circuit, which makes it really easy to charge up completely in a few hours. You can also get chargers that are designed to fit in a particular car. You're right, Tesla does have its own charge connector, but the connectors that are generally used in the United States now for fast charging include that Tesla connector, but also the CHAdeMO standard that came from Asia for the Leaf and other vehicles of that sort, and the CSS standard that came from Germany, which is also used by General Motors for the Bolt for fast charging. So those are all available. It is the fact that not every car can charge on every fast charger, and that's one of the reasons why it's important to have that navigation program that I talked about in my talk, so that you can figure out which chargers will work for your car. And it's easy to configure those programs so that it only gives you the chargers that your car can use. Fast chargers can get you charged in somewhere between 15 minutes and 45 minutes. The level 2 charger, the one that I have in my garage, it may be 3 or 4 hours. You can charge on a standard outlet, even a very large battery, in a couple or 3 days if you're stuck and that's what you're doing. But if you're at your mother-in-law's house out in the country someplace and you're going to be there for 3 days anyway, it works.
I'll just add to that as well. This is Kelly from Lane Transit District. And in the bus market, the market really is coalescing around a standard for charging. In the past, there have been individual chargers that are unique to certain manufacturers, and the industry is really moving towards a standard set of charging infrastructure for electric buses.
Kathleen Petty, City Club member. My son-in-law, who's a chemist, told me that the environmental cost of producing the electric vehicle, the lithium battery, is far, far greater than that of producing the standard vehicle, because of what the battery does to the environment. And so I've decided I'll just hang on to my 2008 Corolla for quite a long time, and then ride my bike along with that, and that should be better for the environment. And also, I just have a quick question I'm wondering if the new EMX buses will be electric.
Hi, this is Kelly from Lane Transit District, and I'll address that question about the MX buses. Right now, LTD has a goal of focusing on our 40-foot electric buses. And the reason for that is due to weight, right? Electric buses, the batteries tend to be very heavy, and the industry is really focused on lightweighting the buses to reduce the overall weight of the vehicles and to be able to have them, you know, be able to move farther with the charge on the buses. But so at this moment, our focus with our commitment to buying those 11 electric buses, those will be focused on our 40-foot fixed route service. But the industry is moving into 60-foot electric buses. There are several manufacturers that are manufacturing those, and so we are watching that and figuring out if that's something that we'd be looking at in the future.
The question about batteries and how you make them is a really good one. I think the way you need to think about any equipment that you buy you intend to use on a regular basis is to think about the cost to the environment of the manufacture of the item itself, and then also the cost of operating it. The cost of manufacturing an electric vehicle battery, your question, is a bit higher than the cost, the environmental cost, than the cost of building a conventional internal combustion engine car. Two reasons for that. One is the technology for these large lithium-ion batteries is pretty new, and they're still working on getting that, refining those so the cost is lower. But when you consider the fact of the fuel that goes into the car and the maintenance that goes into the car, the electric car catches up in about 6 months with a gasoline-powered car, and after that, it goes way ahead in terms of smaller environmental impact. So when you're thinking about any piece of equipment, when you're comparing the cost of manufacturing it versus the cost of operating it, remember, the cost of manufacturing it is a very small portion of the total life cycle cost of the vehicle. Vastly higher is the cost of, in this case, fuel for operations. So I think your chemist son is correct. I would leave out the word a lot, or I forget exactly, great amount. I'd leave that out because it isn't a great amount more, it's a little bit more. But because you're using electricity, which is getting cleaner all the time, everywhere in the world, and of course in our area is very clean already, the electric car has great advantage from an environmental point of view very quickly.
Michael Graham from Columbia Willamette Clean Cities Coalition. I just wanted to add, so in terms of environmental cost, if we're talking about carbon emissions, the life cycle carbon emissions of an electric vehicle in the U.S. are going to be less than a comparative gasoline-powered vehicle, even on some of those more coal-heavy or natural gas grids, because of two reasons. One, when there's the efficiency of an electric vehicle that helps to make the usage of that, you know, that, let's say it's a quote-unquote fossil-generated electron, go a lot farther than the fossil gasoline in your internal combustion engine car. Two, when a gasoline-powered internal combustion engine car comes off the line, its carbon footprint set. That's not going to improve. When you have an electric vehicle that comes off the line, its carbon footprint will actually gradually decrease as the electric grid in the United States also decarbonizes. We've seen a lot of wind power come online, solar power. Certain years where we have a higher water year, we'll have more hydropower generation. So, and we are moving towards a lower carbon electricity mix in the United States, slowly but surely. My one other consideration is when we talk about environmental costs of battery production, where have we been in terms of our smartphones, laptops, tablets? These are still the largest source, the largest. These still create the largest demand for lithium-ion batteries in the world. So just something else to consider.
Yeah, I'm Jack Dresser, and like Phil, I am a clinical psychologist who's turned to public issues. And my main public issue focus is to expose and oppose the atrocities of American imperialism. Now, how does this relate to this? Well, we've just seen another CIA-orchestrated coup in Bolivia. Bolivia happens to have the largest lithium deposits in the world. Lithium is the lightest metal on Earth and is obviously the key to the future of electric vehicles, which is the future of vehicles. So I'm wondering if there is a movement afoot to require manufacturers to identify the source of their lithium and to identify it as a conflict mineral, such as the coltan in your cell phone, which is also the product of American imperialism in the Congo. So anyway, I'm wondering if such a movement is afoot.
So I'm not, this is Kelly Hale from Lane Transit District. I'm sure there are other efforts going on, but I'd like to highlight on one in particular. I don't know if anybody is familiar with the Carbon Disclosure Project, CDP, but this is an initiative to require that the world's largest organizations, businesses, start reporting on some of the risks that they face in their business model on climate change to their investors. This is an investor-based disclosure mechanism that is happening in the world. And so it's trying to get at disclosure of some of these things within supply chains of organizations so that we can understand what some of the impacts are from the things that we're buying. So that might be one thing that is afoot that is addressing some of the concerns you raise.
Yeah, I read recently that the coal company...
Hold on. All right, next question. Thanks. Thanks, Jack.
Randy Prince, City Club member. Very nice to hear about the benefits of battery-powered electric vehicles, including the buses. Electric, clean electric buses have been running for 80, 100, maybe more years in major cities in the United States. Seattle, San Francisco operate them throughout Europe. Those depend on trolley wires overhead, transportation corridors that focus dense development. But there's been problems to coordinate maintaining those wires in a dense urban environment. Bus companies have attempted to discontinue them. Riders have said, no, we want these clean, quiet buses. I'm wondering what is the fate of the trolley systems, because on the one hand, they are existing and everything, but the lithium batteries have advantages and disadvantages of being a non-renewable material. What's the state of those trolley systems versus the lithium technology for transit systems?
So this is Kelly from Lane Transit District. I can't speak to the fate for the entire set of transit agencies across the country related to trolley-based electric vehicles. I know that they are working well in many areas where they've already been installed. The challenge where they don't already exist is that they require significant infrastructure investments. And so the benefit of the battery electric bus today for transit agencies and other public transit companies that operate within the country are that the battery electric bus can run without that additional infrastructure being implemented. And so that's one of the additional benefits, and that's why there's such a movement where those wires don't already exist and some of the challenges that you mentioned. The movement is towards battery electric buses to extend range and be able to implement that same quiet electric ride in places that don't already have that infrastructure.
Michael Graham from Columbia Willamette Clean Cities. I would say that I could see the two technologies working very harmoniously together, because you have the advantages of having a fixed wired bus that doesn't require recharging and returning to base, so you have more frequent and extended service. And then it's complemented by the battery electric buses, which have zero emissions and are more free to, you know, go away from the wires within the city.
Sue Walling, City Club member, and full disclosure, I'm a long-term bicycle advocate and transit supporter. I think we can all agree that electric vehicles are a lot cleaner than gas vehicles, and the development of buses and delivery trucks electric is really exciting. But it still seems to me like you have to build the vehicles, which is a very carbon-heavy and extractive kind of process. You have to eventually get rid of, dispose of the vehicles with the toxins of the batteries. You're still going to have congestion. You still have to build and maintain roads and bridges and highways and parking spaces for all these vehicles. And it still supports a kind of dispersed land use pattern, which is part of our climate problem. So especially in a city like Eugene, where the average trip is a mile or two, how big a role should electric automobiles in particular play in our carbon problem?
Thank you. This is Phil Barnhart. Thank you. That is a fantastic question. And I've thought about the answer to it quite a bit. The reality is that we have got to get rid of our carbon footprint very fast. We've got a decade, maybe a little longer than that, to really completely switch the way we use energy in our system. Cities in the United States have been laid out to accommodate the automobile for 100 years. The streetcar system we were just talking about was bought up by the automobile manufacturers in the 1920s and destroyed, closed. Oregon, or Eugene, you can still see the tracks if you look around. They're still there. We do definitely need to get to city planning that allows for walking for most trips, that allows for bicycles for others, that uses the bus much more than it does now. We are not going to get there in 10 years. I see the electric car and electric delivery trucks and a variety of other heavy trucks as a bridge between now and the time when we can actually have the the layouts for our cities that will promote those other much lower energy intensive forms of transportation. But we have to have it now because we have to get rid of the internal combustion engine and the gasoline and oil use that we have now immediately.
This is Kelly from Lane Transit District, and I'll just add to that. We need all the solutions, and we need them now. And so I'll pose it to all of you to say, how can we bring more money into transit? If we're really going to get serious about addressing the climate crisis, we would need to quadruple or even more the amount of funding we have to provide transit service on our roads to be able to get people to the places that they need to go. How can we find those funding sources? How can we re-envision our future to provide more options for folks beyond just the personal vehicle? Thanks.
Michael Graham, Columbia Willamette Clean Cities. I'm a city planner by education here at the University of Oregon. And full disclosure, as a Los Angeles native, I would say you cannot build your way out of congestion. It's bad.
Yeah. Good afternoon. I'm Gary. I've been a city club member for a whole 6 months.
All right.
4 months ago I spoke to Rodney of eWeb about electric cars, and I suggested it would take a threefold increase in electricity in order to meet a fleet demand. Rodney went on to say that it would probably be more. Keep this in mind. You go down the city street, you see one power line down. It would take four power lines to meet the demand of electric car fleet. Rodney went on to say that the distribution was not the main problem, but the actual generation of electricity. My question is, what is your advice to Rodney and how eWeb can meet the huge demand put on by increased use of electric cars?
This is Kelly from Lane Transit District. So yes, the availability of electricity is a question as we move into a future where electric vehicles matter and are being used more and more. The first point is that we have to be smart about when we are using that electricity, and we have to figure out how we can smooth out the demand so that we have the available resources that we need. And in this area, it's important that we take that into account at eWeb. And based on not just eWeb, but all of the utilities throughout the state of Oregon to understand our demand patterns and understand when we are using that electricity and be smart about when we are charging our vehicles. Right now, there is electricity that's available to us at night when most people are sleeping, and that's a main point of time when electric vehicles can be charged. The peak time that is of a special concern that would require bringing on new sources of generation would be that evening peak. And that's the kind of 5 to 7 p.m. time frame. And so we need to figure out strategies to avoid charging during that peak times that the utilities have already identified that power could become short, and figure out ways through technology and other tools in order to smooth out that demand and use electricity at other times of the day.
Michael Graham, Columbia Willamette Clean Cities. The sad truth is that our grid is fairly old and is not created for what today we are seeing is a very flexible, you know, a very variable generation consumption, especially with electric vehicles coming into their own. So we look to California, for example, and we see what's known as a duck curve, where you have low consumption in the evening periods and then high consumption near the peaks, and it's balancing out this duck curve, which actually electric vehicles can help with what's known as vehicle-to-grid technology. So you can take all of those vehicles that are, for example, parked at an office lot, let's say they're electric, and plugging into charge, and you can use that as spare battery capacity to balance grid demand. But to your point about needing new generation and infrastructure at large fleet sites, that is true. In certain instances, you will need to upgrade the substation, or at minimum, you'll need to upgrade the circuit boards at sites to accommodate especially larger, medium, and heavy-duty vehicles that are all electric.
Another piece, this is Phil. Another piece of the answer is related to the fact that refining gasoline and other fossil fuels requires a lot of electricity. We get our gasoline from the Seattle area, where a lot of electricity is used for the refining process. If instead of using that electricity for refining gasoline, it was used instead to directly fuel electric vehicles, that would also be a useful thing. When I talked with EWEB, the Emerald People Utility Board, and others, they are really concerned about the need to build more infrastructure. And the way you avoid that is by doing your charging at night. If we ever get to the point where we have a lot of solar in use, then charging in the middle of the day, when there's a lot of extra solar that can't actually be used for other purposes, would also make sense. The issue that you raise is one that has been in the forefront of the electrical utility industry as they think about this process for at least a decade. But there are very clear workarounds that people are continuing to work on. And the one that EWEB and EPUD have suggested is that if you have an electric car, charge it at night.
May I make one statement, please?
I'm sorry.
We have Sandra Bishop. Room for basically one more question.
Sandra Bishop, longtime City Club member, have a couple questions. I'm going to make it short and go to one that we discussed around the table. It's understandable the lifetime cost of having an electric vehicle, but the upfront cost for someone who has an hourly wage worker or close to poverty level, it's not going to happen. You're not going to be able to afford. Even middle-class folks, a lot of them, can't afford the initial cost of an EV. So wanted to kind of challenge the EV Association to see, can you put together some sort of a lending plan or some kind of share thing so that you could actually loan money to a working-class family so they could purchase the car and then pay you back with the savings that they're not going to spend on the gas or the electricity? So would you consider some kind of innovative thing so they can spread out this wealth of being able to do something about lowering your carbon footprint? Thanks.
Thank you, Sandra. This is Phil Barnhart. I appreciate the plug for the Emerald Valley Electric Vehicle Association. I just simply will note that it's a voluntary organization that currently has about 80 members, and I think our bank account has about $200 in it. So we're not going to be doing the things you're talking about, but I will point out that most of the manufacturers will allow will be able to allow you a tax credit on your federal taxes. The state of Oregon will pay $2,500 toward the purchase of a new car. If you're a low-income person, they'll pay up to $5,000 toward the purchase of a new car or a used car, or $2,500 toward a used car. That's the case now. But one of the things that's really important to know is that only 25% of people, of families, buy new cars. Everyone else buys a used car for exactly the reasons that you said. That's true with gasoline-powered cars. And so my suggestion is, if you're one of those people who's in the market for a lower-priced car, do figure out what your actual use is. There are a number of three-year-old Nissan Leafs available that cost $7,000 or $8,000 or $9,000 that will give you many, many years of good service if you're driving mostly around town. People should consider those kinds of things. When the people in the radio audience or here who can actually buy a new car decide to get their second new car, electric vehicle, that first one will be for sale as a used car, and you could buy that one.
So. One more comment, then we got to cut it short. Sorry.
I just wanted to say, this is Kelly from Lane Transit District, that riding the bus is a lot less expensive than owning a car. And so if you want to have access to transportation, it's only $350 for a day pass to ride LTD, and we're trying to make electric vehicles an option for you. And remember that downtown service is free. So we're also trying to make sure that the bus goes where you need to go and expand night and weekend service as well to address workers who work in service jobs and are trying to provide for their families. So thank you so much.
Okay. All right. Well, this has been a great program. We have several questioners still left, but we had hoped that you continue this conversation, let our officials know, and really keep the pressure on for bringing our city up to some kind of solution as we go forward. Before we thank today's speakers, there are a few quick announcements. We'd like to thank our other in-kind sponsors. That's KRVM 91.9 Radio, PAC Info and Simplified Computing LLC, Dot Dotson's Photography and Network Charter School. And a special thanks to radio station KLCC for airing City Club programs on Monday nights at 6:30 p.m. And also to Community Television of Lane County, Cable Channel 29, for televising recent City Club programs. Next week, we will look at asset poverty, which is a household's inability to access wealth resources that are sufficient to provide for basic needs for a period of 3 months. Home ownership, real estate, stocks, savings, bonds, and life insurance policies are all factors that can help sustain when financial hardships occur. Join us next Friday to discuss addressing asset poverty from owing to owning. More details and information about future programs can be found online at City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org, and you can also submit program ideas and become a member there. Now, let's thank our speakers for today. Phil Barnhart, Kelly Howell, and Michael Graham. This concludes today's program.